Sunkfield. Tell us when and where you were born.
I was born June 26, 1940, in Atlanta, Georgia. Mm-hmm. Okay. I was a Grady baby. Born at Grady Hospital in Atlanta.
Okay. And let's see. Tell me a little bit about what did your father do? What was your family do? What was your family like growing up?
Well, I was the only son. Mm-hmm. And I was the son of Mr. and Mrs. Aaron Sinkfield was my father's name, and my mother's name Elizabeth Sinkfield. My father worked for the railroad, and he was a cook. And I guess that's where I get my training, so to speak, in terms of a cook. My mom, she worked for a dry cleaning company, and she was what they call a silk finisher. She did the fine, delicate type garments. And she worked there. That was the only job that I've known her to have. And my father, he worked for the railroad until his health turned bad. And that was the only job that I've known him to have.
Okay. So they were pretty stable.
They were pretty stable.
Okay. Well, now, growing up, whereabouts in Atlanta did you live? Remember where was it?
I was in what they called at the time Southwest Atlanta. Uh-huh. It was an area in Atlanta, in certain parts of Atlanta, the neighborhoods have certain names, so to speak. And I was raised up in the Pittsburgh community.
Okay.
The Pittsburgh community got its name because it was close to a railroad, and the smoke and the cold reminded the area of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, so that area was named uh-huh. the Pittsburgh area.
Uh-huh. Okay. Now, what was school like going to school in I guess the 40s and the 50s? What was school like in the Atlanta area, Southwest Atlanta in those days?
Well, during that time, it was not a whole lot of elementary schools in the area for blacks, but they did have one particular school in the Pittsburgh area, which was W.H. Crockman Elementary School. It was named after William Henry Crockman, which was a black professor that was instrumental in getting Spelman College rolling and the Carver School going and this type of thing. And so I attended Crockman Elementary School, which is a historic site at this point. It was vacant.
How do you spell that?
C-R-O-G-M-A-N.
Crockman, okay.
It was vacant for several years and just sitting there. And we have recently redeveloped that school and made it an apartment complex. And we have a set aside for senior citizens, and we also have a set aside for some substitute type stuff, and we built apartments around it. So this is one of the initiatives that the community have taken.
Great.
Is it a historic plaque out in front of the school?
No, it's not a historic plaque out in front of the school, but what we're in the process of doing now is trying to make the whole Pittsburgh area a historic community.
Okay, make it a historic district.
And the Crockman School is one of the areas that we are keying in on to make this happen.
Do you have any of your associates here in your group that went to that school also?
No, as a matter of fact, I'm probably the only person that's in the Lockheed Retirees group that was born and raised in the Pittsburgh area and went to Crockman School.
Okay.
Speaking of Crockman and speaking of Pittsburgh, I am the vice president of the Pittsburgh Community Improvement Association.
Okay.
And this is why I know about the trying to get the Pittsburgh area a historic district, a historic community.
How did you get to school? You walked?
School was right across the street.
Okay.
Crockman School is on West, WEST Avenue.
Uh-huh.
And I was born and raised on West Avenue. And I stayed on West Avenue until I that I got grown and moved out and married and just like that.
Okay.
So it doesn't matter walking to school.
Okay. So, but yeah, and those are in the days of the segregated schools, and so you said there weren't a lot of black elementary schools. I know we talked to Mr. Kemp the other day, and he said that when they changed places, they moved within Cobb County in the new community they moved to, there was no black school for 2 years. So was that fairly
common?
The
problem school was the only school on the south side of town, taking in. And here again, I'm mentioning some neighborhood names, uh-huh. Mechanicsville, uh-huh. Peoplestown, Summerhill, Adair Park. All those schools were surrounding the Pittsburgh area. Most of the people that lived in those areas attended Providence School.
I don't like this, yeah, what is it? Mechanicsville.
Mechanicsville.
Uh-huh. Summerhill.
Summerhill.
Okay.
Peoplestown.
Adair Park.
Yeah. Those are just some of the names of some of the small communities that were surrounding.
And so that school basically served the whole area.
Right.
Whereas if you'd gone a little further north, you'd have had schools all over the place. Yeah, yeah. For each of these communities, right. I see what you mean. Yeah.
These were not in Pittsburgh, though, right?
No.
That's another.
Right. Pittsburgh. But they had to come from all over to, if they wanted to go to elementary school.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So what about high school or middle school or junior
high
school?
Well, there were no middle schools or high school in the Pittsburgh area.
Mm-hmm.
I first attended high school at Booker T. Washington High School. And that was in northwest side of town,
right.
Over off of Hunter Street, in that area.
How'd you get there? Did you?
Had to ride the bus.
Yeah,
ride the bus. And or walk. It was a pretty little walk.
Yeah.
And I went to.
See, was there a gap in your education there?
No.
Elementary school went through what grade?
It went through the seventh grade at the time, and then you attended eighth grade starting high school.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So there was no gap there.
Okay.
And I attended the eighth, ninth, and tenth grade, if I'm not mistaken, at Booker T. Washington High School. And they was in the process of building Price High School, which was closer to the Pittsburgh area than Booker T. Washington. And when Price was completed, I transferred from Booker T. Washington to Price. And I was in Price High, if I'm not mistaken, the third graduating class that was graduated.
So
I went in 10th grade, I believe. I went to the 10th, 11th, and the 12th.
10th grade. How far a bus ride? How long did it take you to get to school?
We walked to Price. Price was approximately 4 miles.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Of course, you know, we could catch the bus and go, but you know.
How long did it take you to get to Booker T. Washington?
To Booker T. Washington, I would say 30 minutes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And about 20 minutes to get to Price High by walking.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
You could ride the bus and get there by Price.
Did your family have a car?
Yeah, but it was up and down all the time. I do remember that car, and I do remember when I. I'm not sure of the year. It was not a new car, but I finished Price High School in 1958, and I chose not to go to one of the colleges in the AU area, Marsh Brown, Claude Morehouse. I decided to go to. As a matter of fact, I got a little money from the Board of Regents, if you understand where I'm coming from here, because my major was engineering.
Uh-huh.
And I got a little money from the Board of Regents to attend one of the predominantly black colleges, rather than to apply for Georgia Tech.
Uh-huh.
One of those other. So I chose Hampton Institute.
Okay.
I'm from Norfolk, Virginia.
Oh, yeah. Of course, it's Hampton University now.
Yeah.
But I chose Hampton Institute, and I got somewhat of a scholarship there and got a little subsidized money from the Board of Regents.
Yeah.
And that's
and they did that because there was not a comparable institution in Georgia that was predominantly black. Is that and
exactly.
So they had a policy of, remember that. That was fairly common at the time.
Right.
Southern states would do that to get around having to have equal facilities. They'd just pay you to go somewhere else.
Yeah.
So, All right. So, and you studied engineering at Hampton Institute.
Well, I started out in engineering, but I didn't complete it in engineering. Mm-hmm. What happened? And we was talking about the car early. My dad bought a car, but it was not a brand new car. But it was a car to drive me to Hampton when I first went to Hampton. It was a Pontiac. Mm-hmm. What year was I can't remember.
You finished in 58, so it was like 1959 or 60.
No. I went to Hampton in 58, but the car he bought was not in 1958. It was an early model car. I thought it was a new car, one of the new cars. The car was probably 5 or 6 years old, maybe a little older than that, but it got us to, it was a Pontiac that had the Indian on it. You know the little Indian?
I remember.
That, okay. So you know what the I do remember. Yeah, but he was asking me, I didn't finish in engineering. The reason being is that engineering at that time at Hampton was a 5-year major. Mm-hmm. And my mom got sick my sophomore or junior year, one of the two. And I had to come out of school for a while. And I stayed out, I guess, 6 months or so. When I went back, I had got I's in all of my courses, which was incomplete. Mm-hmm. And in order to finish with the class that I started with, in 5 years, mm-hmm. I changed my major from engineering to business with an accounting minor. And that's what I ended up doing.
Okay.
When did you finish there?
Pardon me?
When did you get your degree?
1963.
1963.
Okay. Okay, and then, so what did you do after that? Where did you, when you were looking for employment after that, what was your, how did you proceed after that?
Well, after that, I kind of hung around in Washington, D.C. for a while. I had a buddy at the time, well, not a buddy, but a friend, so to speak, that knew the principal of Garnett Patterson in Washington. Mm-hmm. And, I did a little subbing there for, I guess, 2 or 3 months. And I just decided that one for me, so I came home. And when I came home, Lockheed was hiring. And I got a job probably making more money than I would have been making if I had been teaching. Mm-hmm. When I applied for Lockheed, I went through Georgia State at the time, was, I'm not even sure where it was downtown.
Trinity, Washington.
You know, well, now it was in the downtown area. I don't believe they had an employment office on site at Lockheed at that time.
Just the early days.
Yeah.
Probably where you went, the corner of Trinity Street, Washington, and big building, it's the Georgia State Employment Service. So, if you recall, you probably went to the Lockheed.
I don't remember.
You don't remember.
But anyway, I went there and filled out an application and they sent me up here and I was hired.
So that was in 63 still? That would have been 64?
It was really in 65.
Oh, I'm 65. Yeah. Okay, so 65.
I was hired in May of 1965.
May 65.
Yeah.
And so what was your job? What was your first job?
My job, I was hired in as an assembly helper.
Okay.
The lowest thing on the totem pole. However, like I mentioned, and I do remember what I was making when I hired in. I hired in making $2.22 an hour.
Okay.
And you may not want to mention this on your thing, but at the time, you know, the lottery was not legal.
Right.
Yeah, but they had what they called the bug. They played numbers and whatnot. And it was ironic that my salary was $2.22. And I've been playing that number, $2.22.
Did you ever hit it?
Nah. I'm just a couple of days, you know, after I got. But the $2.22 was, at that time was more than the early on, you know, teachers that were just starting out.
Oh, yeah.
So I was happy with that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
And
what day of the month did you have? Your
seniority
day?
I do, yeah, it was May 5th.
May
5th.
The reason I ask is, Reginald Kemp and I have the same seniority day.
Yeah, it was May 5th, 1965.
We were May 14th.
Yeah, both y'all May 14th.
So,
okay.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, no, you go ahead. What happened? So you come to work. How was it?
It was an experience, man. This place was huge, and you know, I got lost a couple of times. And you know, I was still a young man, and I guess amazed with the workforce, building up airplanes and whatnot. But
you started with training, though, didn't you?
Pardon me?
You, the first thing you did was go through training, right?
I don't believe I had any training. I think it was sort of like on the job training. By me being a helper, you know, they assigned you with someone that was pretty well experienced, and then, you know, you kind of got your training from that
question.
It's not like it was in the later years, you know, where they send you through a period of 3 or 4 weeks to show you how to shoot rivets and drill holes. I don't believe I had all that.
Yeah,
I think the guy that I was working with, if I'm not mistaken, he's one of the lobby retired men, but his name is Casey. Gilstrap? Yeah. I was putting Gilstrap on.
Okay.
Now, what department was that in? Remember?
Looked like it was 2639.
All right, what airplane were you working on?
I started on this 141.
2639.
I believe it was 2639.
Okay, that's good.
Now, when you went, so when you come in May 65, did they, the plants, is the line that you're running integrated at that point, is that right?
Yeah.
There are the blacks and whites on the line.
Yeah, it was integrated at that time. There were blacks and whites at that time working together.
What's your recollection of that, about how that went early on? How was that? Was there any... Did you observe any particular problems or tensions or anything?
Oh yeah, it was still some tension there, and it was still a little bit of segregation still there. Mm-hmm. You know, the blacks they normally kept it themselves, and the white normally kept it themselves. They had the little area that they eat in, the white had the little area that they eat in, and this type of thing.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Even though it wasn't no signs or
no
anything,
signs,
but they just
there,
sort of did
this.
Yeah.
It was sort of that way, uh-huh. And believe it or not, in terms of your job assignments and whatnot, if you had to get in a little small hole, or if you had a job that requires you to get a lot of cylinders on you in a dirty job, naturally you know who got this job.
I can imagine, yeah, I can imagine.
But and I worked as an assembly helper for a short period. I'm not
usually during your probationary period you get promoted.
Yeah. And then they promoted me to what they call an assembly installer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that was probably 90 days or so after I was hired in.
Mm-hmm.
Which allowed me to kind of work on my own.
Mm-hmm.
When you are an assembly helper, you normally help someone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, go get the rivets on and drill holes, clamp this, back up this, bug this rivet, you know, that type of thing.
Did you work with white people where you bucking the rivet and somebody is running the rivet gun?
Not early on, no, not then. I mean, you know, my partner was a black partner.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, because we worked on the same airplane. They didn't have airplanes at that time that all blacks was on, and another airplane all white was on.
Were you assigned like that?
Yeah.
Supervisor.
I was assigned.
You work for this guy.
Yeah. He told me who he wanted me to work with, and I worked with that guy up until I got promoted to be a 358, and the 358 was sort of like a jack of all trades.
Right.
Early on, you know, to get away with 358, but 358 was supposed to be able to do structural type jobs, and it was supposed to have a minimum knowledge of electrical type jobs. I mean, he was just a floater. He
mm-hmm.
he could do just about whatever they wanted him to do,
mm-hmm.
and be above board in terms of not crossing the line in terms of what,
mm-hmm.
you know, job classification and whatnot. So I stayed at 358, I guess, for about maybe a year or so.
Mm-hmm.
And I picked up fast.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I could do my job and watch somebody else do their job and kind of
mm-hmm.
pick out what was going on with
mm-hmm.
that.
Did you have some blueprint training along the way here?
I believe I did.
I think you had to.
Yeah, I believe I did have a group in training. And by my early on major being architectural engineering, see, I was no real dummy when it came to figuring out.
You had some background, yeah.
Mentors and you know.
Right.
Certain views and this type of thing.
Right.
And I was always helpful, always trying to make sure that the group that I was in did a good job, a good quality job and whatnot. And the supervisor that I was working for recognized that. So he called me off to the side one day and he said, you know what? He said, yeah, I appreciate it, the way you are carrying yourself and the help that you're giving other guys, the newer fellows that come in, although I was not elite person. Mm-hmm. My manager at the time was Hall Caswell.
Oh, gosh, I know.
And my supervisor was Roy Foster.
Those are white guys.
Yeah, those are white guys. But in my estimation, both of those are good guys. If you get my name.
Yeah.
And,
Hall was a tough...
He was tough, but he was fair. See, I don't care how tough you are, as long as
there's a lot of hard-nosed...
As long as you're fair, you know what I mean?
The career production managers, they couldn't fool around because they had to produce.
Okay. So Hall, Roy called me to the side and talked to me, and he took me to talk to Caswell. They made me a lead person, undercover, under the table. And when I say under the table, this is what happened. Nobody knew I was a lead person.
Uh-huh.
I was getting lead man's or lead person's money.
About 20 cents.
Right? Yeah, 20 cents more than the highest paid man in that crew.
Uh-huh.
You got to understand now that I was a 358. They had other people in that crew that was making more money than I was making.
Right.
So when I got the lead man under the cover, I got more than just the 20 cents on the hour. I got the difference between what the 358 was making and what that top person was making,
right,
plus
right,
an additional 20 cents.
Uh-huh.
So that may have been 56 to 70 cents. You follow what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Let me explain that. There's a rate range. 358 is your code for assembly installers. The helper was 360, as I recall.
I don't remember.
And they all had a rate range. Uh-huh. And you progressed in your rate range based on merit increase.
Yeah.
Reviews. So what he's saying is that they moved him up and over the pay over other guys. Would that include white guys?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Sure did.
Is that why they wanted it to be under the table?
Because, see, at that time, in order for you to be the lead person, there was two things that had to happen. You had to be the most senior qualified. Okay?
Right.
And that's kind of hard to define
sometimes. Yeah.
So what they did was kind of did it on the table. And I just went around doing my thing, and everybody just thought I was just being so helpful. They didn't know I was really getting the money for it.
That's good.
And then through attrition and some other things, it finally come to the point where by those other guys moving to other areas, it finally got to the point where I was the most senior person in that crew.
Right.
And so then it blossomed out.
Why do you reckon they did it, that they kept it under, do you think it was the race?
No.
Or it was because of the seniority
the
thing
union,
and the union rules? That's what I thought.
Yeah, it was more or less for the union thing.
Right. They couldn't really technically call you the lead man because the union would get upset.
Yeah, because they had other people in the crew that's been out longer.
Right.
Probably just as qualified. Right. More, I don't think, because I was...
Right.
You know, I learned quite quick.
But you were doing the job they wanted done and doing it well, and so they wanted you to do it. Yeah, I understand. Yeah.
Plus, in fact, I was good with paperwork, and, you know, I was not there. And there was a lot of guys like that around here that had, you know, college experience and all this other kind of stuff, and they weren't the run-of-the-mill guys, and they stood out like sore thumbs.
Right.
I mean, you know, you could tell.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. But they were happy, just like I was happy, because, you know, although you was doing... you know, just labor work, so to speak, you were still, and my main thing is the money.
Right.
You know what I'm talking
right.
about?
Right.
At that time, it was the money.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I didn't care nothing about wearing no coat and tie and all that stuff.
Right.
If I was making more money than this person down here with a coat and tie, you know, you follow what I'm saying?
Yeah, sure.
You know, that's true.
Let me deal with that just a little bit. Now, that also applies to when you went back home and where you were regarded in the community by your friends and everything.
Exactly.
You were proud to be working for Lockheed?
Yes, everybody was.
And
at that time,
I think that's what you're saying.
Everybody was. At that time, when especially from the neighborhood that I was in and certain areas, man, when you had that Lockheed badge on, you walk into a
store.
A store, anything. I mean, you got a certain amount of respect. I mean, if you needed credit, I mean, they didn't run no extensive credit check on it. They just about gave you credit immediately because you were a Lockheed employee. And I remember, you know, you put that badge on, you get off work at 3:30, 4 o'clock, you may 7 o'clock, you maybe still walk around that badge.
I love it.
Working now.
Sure.
Well, now, before you had wear the badge and everything, did you have any problem with buying clothes from clothes stores?
No, I didn't, because, believe it or not, I had already kind of established myself. What happened when my mom decided that we decided I was going to go to Hampton, she opened up me an account at one of the finer clothing places in Atlanta. I'll never forget, it was Anthony's Clothing Store. And I would go there and purchase stuff on time and pay them and whatnot. So I had already kind of started up and developed a little credit history.
Was that store in the black community?
No, it was downtown. It was downtown. And okay. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I had other people tell me that Bond Clothes, you remember that? Bond Clothes was a place where you could get good credit and everything.
I don't remember that.
And where? A black friend of mine said he was in Chicago and he got bought clothes from Bond Clothes, but he was down here and they wouldn't let him buy anything. Of course, they wouldn't let him try on any clothes either. So that's why I was asking if you apparently didn't have that personal experience.
No, I didn't have that experience, but a lot of did, you know.
You did have friends that had that experience.
Yeah. Well, Lockheed would allow them to get credit when, before then, they were not able to. Yeah. But I think that I would have been able to get one, regardless. But, you know, certainly having...
You had a little more background.
Having the Lockheed badge on.
Didn't hurt.
Okay, so I stayed... lead person for a few years, and not a few years. I don't know. And to make a long conversation short, I was in management less than 5 years. I was hired in
supervisor.
What happened now during that time, different than what it is now. You know, now if the manager wanna make you a supervisor, he just points you out, send you to get your salary badge, and they got the paperwork, and it's a done deal. But during that time, now I don't know about the whites, but during that time, if you were black, you had to take a test. You remember? Do you remember where the whites had to take tests also?
Yes, they did. It's called management selection. Management selection.
Okay.
So California tested about maturity is what it was. One was the math and one was the language parts.
The thing about it is, at that time, Roy Foster was a real good guy to me. And like I say, all cast World War II. And they talked to me the same way they did when they talked to me about the lead man job and told me that they had a lot of management skills and a lot of potential here and a lot of potential there, and they suggested that I take the management test.
Okay.
I took it.
You must have done well.
But I could not get, and I have not today found out what my score was, how I did on the test. And I took the test, and it was a month or two, man, before I could really do anything. And I just started not raising no hell, but I just let them know that I was concerned about whether I passed the test and I wasn't going to do this. And then all of a sudden, Kevin just called me in there and told me that he was going to make the supervisor. So evidently, he found that.
Okay, what year was that now?
Excuse me. What's up there?
Year that you became survivor? Plus or minus.
1969. Okay. Okay. And supervisor, what were you, what area were you in supervisor? What were you doing?
I was in supervisor of the tail section of the aft fuselage for the 141 program.
How many blacks were there? What was the mixture of blacks and whites in that department?
In that department at that time?
Yeah, just to generalize.
About a third, I suppose.
About a third. Okay. And you had whites under your crew.
And that was an ordeal too.
Tell us about that. How did that work? How did that?
Yeah. Well, when I say that was an ordeal, I'm not speaking. It was an ordeal from two standpoints. It was an ordeal because the whites did not want the blacks telling them what to do. And it was an ordeal because the blacks was envious. And I had more problems trying to get them to do what they were supposed to do because I was black and they was black and they thought they were supposed to receive some kind of special treatment and this type of thing. And that's what I mean when I say ordeal. But over a period of time, being a sort of a fair person, I gained respect from the blacks and also the whites. And my performance was always a cut above. That's true.
I'm sure. Okay. This is the half section of 141. Uh-huh. That'd be the tail assembly.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, the aft section is the only section that I have ever worked on. Mm-hmm. On all three airplanes. All the airplanes I worked on the aft fuselage because there's some commonality between all of the planes.
That would be the empennage and the horizontal stabilizer.
Mm-hmm. Not on the 141 it wasn't, it was just the aft fuselage itself.
Okay.
On the C-5, it was just aft fuselage itself. But the C-130, it was the aft fuselage, the horizontal, and the vertical stabilizer and all that was involved in that.
So you were working on, just the horizontal?
No, I worked on the aft fuselage, just the fuselage itself.
Just the aft section of the fuselage?
Right. On the 141.
Right. Okay.
Then left the 141, I went to the C-5, and on the C-5 I also worked just on the aft fuselage side panels. It was not a body mate position, it was building the side panels for the aft fuselage.
How did your group do on schedule and quality?
That's what I just mentioned when I say my performance. I was speaking of schedule and your cost. Stand on the budget, a quality picture, and this type of thing. And we were always the cut above.
Building just one fuselage at a time?
Well, we had, it was a sort of like an assembly type thing, We had the framework where you put your stiffeners and all those in place, and then you come back with your skins and your braces and all that stuff. We built it from scratch.
Okay.
And it was certain stages that you did.
Mm-hmm.
And when you got to the final stage, it was complete there, and then you picked it up and you took it to the body mate position.
Did it stay in position until they pick it up? Did those sections?
It stayed in that particular area where we built that until it was transported.
And finally, when it moved, the crane came in and picked it up
and took it to the body mate position.
Right, mm-hmm. Body mate position. Okay. And you all made all your schedule based on that.
Right.
That's good.
You did.
Did you receive commendations?
Oh, man, I got plenty of
them. Did you?
Yeah, I got all kind of commendations, all kind of Buck Hunter awards.
Okay.
I got all kind of accolades and whatnot while I was in there. Yeah, I got all kinds of plaques.
Cops said, to be eligible for that, you had to submit proof that you saved the company.
Yeah, right. If I got one Buck Hunter award, I got 50.
Really?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Mm-hmm. Well, your education, your architecture, engineering.
Yeah, all kinds of commendations and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I left the C-5. Which is C-130.
Mm-hmm.
And here again on the C-130, I was in the aft fuselage. On the 141, I was working for Roy Foster, and on the C-5, I worked for Roy Foster. When I came to the C-130, First of all, I worked on the C-5 as a supervisor also. and I came to see my third aid. You take when they did to me. You know, normally they will let you know a few weeks ahead of time so you can, because at that time, a lot of the tools that you had checked out, the supervisor had checked them out. Mm-hmm. And they told me on Friday to report to the C-130 on Monday. I did that. When I came to the C-130, Dick Scudder, the manager that I reported to, they had a black supervisor in the area. His name was, had two of them really. One of them was Willie Ed Hill. Another one was Charlie Ferguson. And Charlie Ferguson is the guy that takes the money up.
Okay.
All right. Told me to report to Dick Scudder on the C-130. I reported to Dick Scudder and he introduced himself and whatnot. Then he called Willie Ed Hill. He told Willie Ed Hill to take me out in the shop and show me the area that I was to supervise. Didn't even have a supervisor in the area training. Listen to this story now. When I got out there in the area and Willie Ed Hill took me out in the area, he introduced me to the lead person that was in that area, which was a white guy. A guy named Shin Hosen. Never will forget it. And told me that this is the area that you're supervising, blah, blah, this, blah, blah, that. But there was not a supervisor in that area to give me a head start on what I was supposed to do and none of that. The same day the lead person, he said, St. Phil, he said, let me tell you something, he said, I have been planning on giving up this lead man job for some time. He said, I don't want you to think that I'm giving it up just because you're coming in here. He said, but now is a good opportunity for me to do it, he said, so I'm not your leader. So I had to just learn that area from scratch.
You were in left field.
It was way behind schedule. I was not a supervisor in the area and nothing. I just had to learn. Had stuff from the door all the way back out of station, back in the area. I'm telling you how many hours it was behind schedule and whatnot. And that was an ordeal, man.
Did you ever find out why that had something happened or why it was that they had gotten in it and why there wasn't a supervisor in that area when you got there?
Nobody wanted the supervisor area. Then they had another guy, I can't think of his name. He was back and forth in the area and then he got sick. He got sick.
So they put you in there to clean up this mess.
It was a mess. And they didn't have more than that. It took me a year to get that area back.
Did Shin Holster give you a hard time?
Yeah, he did. Mm-hmm. But you again, I got to him too eventually.
Can you give me an example of what you did?
Well, I mean, when I say hard time, I mean, you know, when I would try to ask him questions about stuff, he would lead me in the wrong direction sometime, or he'd act like he didn't know exactly what was going on, and I had to figure it out for myself.
Mm-hmm. He wasn't helpful at all.
He wasn't helpful at all, but he promised me he would. Yeah. Even when he told me he was going to give the job up, he'd say that if I can be of any help to you, I'd be more than glad to do it. But he wasn't. But after a while, he got to know me and saw that I was a pretty bad person and I wanted to do the right thing. He came around and he started doing some things.
Mm-hmm. When you left that area?
But he never did take a lead person job. Mm-hmm.
When you left that area, how did you feel about Shin Holster at that time?
Well, like I say.
And how did he feel about you?
Good. Real good, because I won him over, and I guess he won me over.
Well, you know, that's the big part of our history here that we're looking at, is how these intolerances on the part of white people and apprehensions on the black people were somewhat resolved as you get to know each other.
Yeah. That's the whole key, I think, is just understanding and knowing a person.
Isn't that the story of life?
Yeah, the ignorance. You know, people are ignorant of a lot of things, and I think that caused a lot of animosity between the two.
You said that earlier on that you know it was pretty obvious that when you it was an ordeal when you became a supervisor for two reasons, and partly because the white guys didn't like being supervised by a black. Can you remember? Do you remember anything specific about, or was that just fairly? How normal was it that you would just hear things going around that so and so said thus and such about the supervisor? In other words, how did that work? How did you pick up on
rumors? The blacks, they thought I had a little chip on my shoulder. You know, I thought I was a little better than they were, whatever the case may be. And like I say, the whites, they just resented the fact that, because some of those guys was there when I came to Lockheed. And a lot of them probably helped me along the way. You know what I mean? Sure. Here I am supervising them and whatnot. It was some resentment there, but
sure.
In the beginning.
Right.
But like I say, every crew that I take over, they may be apprehensive at first, mm-hmm. but over a period of time, when they learn how I operate and how I go straight down the road with that, in my retirement party that I had, I got all kind of accolades from whites and blacks that have worked with me over the years.
That's okay. Mm-hmm. Was that in the plan?
No. It was outside. I had a nice retirement inside, but
I've
had some problems.
Did you go to one of the restaurants or something?
I went to my family gave me one at the Marriott. Uh-huh. Yeah, it was a nice function.
White guys that worked for you came.
The managers and everybody came. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
like all kinds.
Yeah.
Well, that's true.
Yeah.
I mean, congratulations. Started off way down the scale. You would rate when you first came to work, the relationships between you and
the white. Yeah, but it was a struggle the whole way now. Sure. I don't really think that it was peaches and cream.
No.
It was a struggle the whole time, and it was discrimination the whole time.
Sure.
Give you a good idea of what I'm talking about. I was supervisor and I was a good supervisor. But I do know for a fact that white supervisors that made supervisors after I made supervisors, they started out making more money than I was making. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, Marion Davis, and you probably remember this case, filed some kind of a suit about the equality of the pay. Mm-hmm. And I remember that I was called downstairs and given a pay increase and a lump sum of money, which wasn't much. Maybe $1,000 to appease me, mm-hmm. and several other blacks in the management mm-hmm. position was given us mm-hmm. the same thing. Mm-hmm. But even at that, it did brought us up just a little bit. Mm-hmm. They still didn't bring me up that where I was told to be, mm-hmm. as opposed to my experience and the time that I have, you know, in this particular mm-hmm. classification.
Mm-hmm. Were there any manager jobs that you felt like you should have been promoted to?
Oh yeah. And that's part of was part of my complaint. Now, I don't know whether you're aware or not, but the lawsuit that was against Lockheed that the jury turned down as a class action suit, I was one of the named plaintiffs mm-hmm. in that lawsuit.
It's 1971 or 72.
Yeah, I was one of the named plaintiffs in that, okay?
Did you testify that? Were you interviewed?
I was interviewed in terms of giving deposition.
Yeah. That's right.
Yes.
That would have been a Lockheed attorney.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But let me tell you what. Yeah.
Yeah. Tell us that.
Every manager that I worked for, starting from Hall Caswell up until the time that I left Lockheed in 2000. Mm-hmm. Every manager that I have worked for, when he was out for whatever reason, I filled in for him as manager. Mm-hmm. All right?
Okay.
But I never was given the opportunity to make manager. Mm-hmm. My manager retired, and everybody thought, I was assistant manager at that time. Yes, I did. Mm-hmm. Don't forget now, I was an assistant manager mm-hmm. in the department. My manager retired, and everybody in that department and everybody in the plant thought that I was going to be moved up to manager. You know what they did? They merged the departments to keep from making me manager. Mm-hmm. They did that. Mm-hmm. They merged the department. 2309 and 2314 became 2314, and the manager of 2314 was the manager of
the thing, and I was one of three assistant managers. He already had two.
Yeah.
And guess what? When I retired, they split the department back up.
Mm-hmm. When you merged, did you lose your job as assistant manager?
No. I'm telling you now. When they merged the department, the manager of the other department already had two assistant managers because that department was a little larger than the one that I was in anyway.
Yeah.
So I was one of three.
Now that was after the lawsuit, or was that before? Was that one of the ones? In other words, you know, the timing of this, had that already happened, or was this before the complaint? And that was one of the.
That was before.
Was that one of the reasons that you filed?
That was one of the reasons. Yeah.
Okay.
Excuse me. Yeah. Hello. Yes. I'm fine. How are you? Tess, we need to. I'm in a meeting right now. But you need to meet me at the club tonight, okay? All right, well, call me later on in the day then. Call me back later on, okay? All right.
Don't you a bit of the history that I'm aware of that will help you refresh your memory. The lawsuit was preceded by charges of racial discrimination with the EEOC.
Exactly.
And what's her name? Black female song made Linda Darnell. That's not her name. Darnell is her name. She was one of the investigators that came out in Lockheed and investigated the EEOC. And there was something like, I think, 36 complaints put together in the past.
Well, I think we're talking about two separate suits.
Okay.
The one you're talking about, I think, was one that was initiated, like you say, in about 1972, 75, yeah. in that time frame.
Oh, you're talking about the Marion Davis thing?
Yeah, no, that's what you're talking about. The one that I'm talking about was initiated in probably 97, 98, somewhere in that time.
Okay, more recent.
Yeah.
Oh, I was retired then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're talking about two
yeah,
separate
yeah,
things.
You were a part of the latter.
The latter one, yeah.
And
it was 11, what they call named plaintiffs.
Okay.
It was,
okay.
Yeah, were you involved in that lawsuit in the 70s, the one that you
I was not involved in it in terms of being a named plaintiff, but I was involved in it being a supervisor at that time, and then, like I said, Marion Davis and some others were supervisors at that time, and some of the allegations that they were making applied to us.
Sure. Yeah.
And I don't think it ever turned into a class action type of a deal. I think it was more or less some sort of a little settlement, like I say, that okay, this is what we're going to do
right.
From the salary standpoint.
Right.
And I think the one you're talking about was strictly salary.
Right.
The earlier one?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was a class action lawsuit.
It was class action?
It was a class action that was called a determination.
Oh, okay.
And that of discrimination. They sent seven people out to Lockheed from the EEOC to investigate. And I had seven people interface with them because they would say, I want to go down here and I want to talk to someone.
I remember that because I had to, I was interviewed by some people.
Okay.
But I remember vaguely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was one of the ones that was chosen to be interviewed. I do remember having an interview way back then.
Right.
Yeah.
Would that have been one of the EEOC investigators probably interviewed him?
I believe it was.
I would think so.
Yeah, I believe
that.
It was one of those.
Yeah.
One of those
yeah.
folks. Yeah.
And that they came out and stayed for several weeks and pulled together all of this evidence, so to speak, and went down and looked a determination of discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
And then we went into conciliation. I did. And in February 1968, we resolved all of those charges of discrimination except nine. And that was what we called the February 68 conciliation agreement.
Okay.
And we agreed to do a lot of things to improve the situation, and some of the people had legitimate complaints and they were adjusted. But the nine people that held out, remember Frank Adair? It was Adair et al.
No, I don't know
okay.
that name.
He was that. they take one person and a class determination and was Adair et al., meaning Ann Others, and then you have all these other names, okay? Then that was on the charge of discrimination. Then when it went to a lawsuit, the NAACP Legal Defense Fund and the city put money into it. And this was it went to trial in 71 and lapped over in 72. And that was Banks et al. I guess alphabetically.
Yeah.
Banks et al. And they were the nine people that sued. And that trial lasted a long time. That trial lasted 7 months. Not 7 consecutive months. Judge O'Kelly was the judge. But 6 months of trial. And that was the agent. And it was seven after the trial.
Before the verdict. Settled it, is that right?
There was never,
no verdict, but they settled it after.
Well, there was no jury. This was a judge trial.
Right.
You know, it was a judge trial.
But the judge didn't get to make a determination. Y'all settled it. Okay.
That was an interesting time.
So you were at you were a supervisor then from 1969 or 70 until the time you retired. Is that
no. I was an assistant manager. I'm gonna say for about 5 years, maybe 6 years prior to my retirement.
Okay.
From 69 up until I'm gonna say.
Okay.
Then when you retired?
I retired in 2000.
2007.
Yeah, but I'm going to say until about 95, because I was an assistant manager for about 5 years before I retired. Right. Maybe a little longer.
Did that seem like an unusually long time to be a supervisor without moving, or to you?
It was. I had seen guys make managers that came in a long time after me, and performance was not half as good as my performance. I mean, and everybody saw it. I mean, just one me looking at it. I mean, everybody saw that.
Sure.
Two or three times during the course of my latter years, when I was an assistant manager, especially, jobs came available, and the consensus of despite everybody in the department. Cynthia's gonna get that job, but Cynthia didn't get that job.
Did you talk to anybody in management at that time?
Yeah, of course I did. Let me tell you what happened. I talked to Mike Gunner, the son of Ray Gunner, I think.
Yeah, Ray Gunner, yeah. He was a manager.
Yeah. And Mike was sort of like a little, I don't know what he was. But anyway, he was kind of over two or three departments there. And he called me in after they merged the departments and whatnot. And you know what he told me? He said, same thing. He said, I know you thought you was going to get that manager's job. And he said, to be honest with you, he said, I had no idea myself that they was going to merge the departments like that. And he said, these are his exact words, and this is on my deposition and everything else. He said, I apologize for the white race. He didn't say that at my mama in another grade. Which told me, he didn't actually just come out and tell me, but he had to read between the lines.
Right.
He tell him it in that if you have been white, you got that job.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You see what I'm saying?
Sure.
He told me that.
Mm-hmm. I didn't make you feel good.
So I guess what that, I mean, bottom line is, things in some ways did improve over the years.
It did improve a lot over the years,
but
still,
there
was
still
something.
Yeah.
But let me tell you this now, what I've heard. Talking with people who are still at the plant. Mm-hmm. Based on the fact that this latter lawsuit that I told you, it was turned down because there was not enough commonality between the named plaintiffs for it to become
a class
action. Mm-hmm. However, the jurors did say that each individual, or a lot of the individuals, had good merit in terms of suing on their own.
Right.
Okay, this thing had already drawn out about 4 or 5 years. And, you know, it was already a question of where we was going to get nailed with some attorney fees and all that, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I had retired and whatnot at the time, so I decided to just not pursue it anymore. But based on that, I'm understanding that the working conditions are a lot better. The blacks are put in a lot of salary position now that they weren't put in at the time. And the whole nine yards seem to be getting a lot better now than what they were.
Mm-hmm.
They brought in this guy, Ryan, that I never understand, you know, just to say, well, see what we did here? We got mm-hmm. this guy right here in this position right here, so we're not discriminating. Look, mm-hmm. we got this guy mm-hmm. here on the, you know how they do
mm-hmm.
things.
Mm-hmm.
But things are better.
Mm-hmm.
And to make a long conversation short, I don't want nobody to think that I have any malice in my heart whatsoever about Lockheed, because Lockheed has been good to me in a certain sense, and I would shudder to think where I would be today if I was not hired in at Lockheed in 1965.
You feel a lot of the guys feeling like right there. They might have had a hard time, and they don't like to remember those things, but overall, the bottom line, they had a good career.
Yep.
Bread on the table, respectability for what you can do as a skilled person.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I was treated better than most blacks. Reason being is because I was somewhat educated. And I did a good job.
Mm-hmm.
You follow what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And but the discrimination with Daniel, since we kind of said it's not.
Oh, sure. I understand.
Right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Wouldn't want you to say otherwise.
Let me ask you this amount. As a supervisor and as assistant manager, you had new people coming in all the time into your area and department. Did you see any difference in the attitudes of the younger people versus the older people?
Well, yeah. But see, because when they initiated that two-tier system,
mm-hmm.
that brought on a lot of dissension, animosity, or whatever.
Explain that to me.
Yeah,
what
I don't
that
remember
means.
That.
Yeah.
Except
the two-tier system. Yeah. What did that mean? What did that?
That mean that they brought the newer employees in, making a lot less than doing the same job that a person was making,
right.
Making a lot more. In other words, I could be working, doing the same job that you're working, doing, you're making, paraphrasing now, $15 an hour, and I'm making $7 an hour.
They came out of the labor agreement.
So the new workers were not getting paid nearly as much. As
doing the same job.
And so that was, I see,
yeah.
So that was a way for the company to start cutting
right.
costs.
And beforehand, you know, it was a difference.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't a whole lot of difference,
right.
You know. In a few years, you could be
right.
in the top.
But you're not going. But you're coming in there. You're not going to
get.
You ain't ever
going to
get to that.
That was negotiated
into
the labor agreement.
Right, right. That was
having a rough time.
But I imagine that probably did make it tough
yeah.
on the floor to,
right.
manage folks.
To manage.
Absolutely,
right.
That's a hard thing to manage. How did you do it? How do you do that?
Well, you don't just, you know, if a person was hiring to do a job, you know, if you don't want to do it, you know, just let me know.
That's
right.
That's
right. A lot of people got that Burger King. I'd
right.
like to have this job that you're doing now. You
That's
know what
right.
I mean?
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
I know. That had to be tough to manage,
yeah.
though. Yeah.
Okay. Is any other area of class that you feel we need to know about? We're doing the history, we're trying to get your story and your views of the way it was to Lockheed during this period of what we call workplace integration. Because we started off all white, all black jobs. And then when you left, there wasn't that fine distinction that it was earlier. So that's the history that we've started, the history. And you touched on a lot of things that we need to know. About discrimination. You sort of summed it up, though, as I see that when you left, the things as far as race relations are concerned, the abilities of whites and blacks to work together was much, much better.
Much, 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 much better. And, you know, lesson learned over the years and whatnot, we had learned how to kind of work together, respect each other and whatnot, and that's something you earn anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not a given.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And that's not a given between people of the same race.
Right. Yeah.
Much less a given between people of different.
Yeah, anything else we hadn't asked you about that you think we ought to know about? Or you
want I don't have, but what I would do, you know, normally when you have an interview, you know, for a day or so after the interview, some of those things.
Yeah, if anything comes,
absolutely. I jot it down and I give it to you.
Absolutely, get in touch with you and let us know.
Absolutely,
if you think of something you want to tell us, let us know.
That happens in everyday life, you know. Maybe when you talk to your wife, it's in. I wish I had said this.
So I'll jot it down and pass it on.
Absolutely, we'd love that.
And we'll come and we want to get more people to come in and tell their stories. Everybody's individual story.